Hello and welcome to another episode of the Sports Pro Podcast. I am your host for this week's episode. My name is Tom Bassam, and this week we're talking all about the Laureus Sport for Good Index. What is the Laureus Sport for Good Index, you might ask? Well, the Laureus Sport for Good Index is now in its third year, and it's a joint initiative between us over here at Sports Pro and our friends at Laureus, where we highlight and spotlight some of the brands using the power of their platform to support sport for good. Now, in this week's episode, I'm lucky enough to be joined by a couple of very special guests. First up, we have a Laureus Academy member, a former Springbok, and famously a Rugby World Cup winner, Mr. Brian Habana, talking to us about how brands can work with athletes to promote positive social messaging. And after I've checked in with Brian, I'm also going to be chatting with Harish Starmer, the global head of sport at TikTok, to talk about how the social video platform is using its own technology to promote that social change messaging. Now, I think you've heard enough from me. Over to Brian. Brian Habana, welcome to the Sports Pro Podcast.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Brian, you are here because you are a Laureus Academy member, and we're talking today about the Laureus Sports for Good Index, which is a joint initiative between Sports Pro and Laureus, which looks to highlight a selection of brands each year doing sport for good, an area obviously Laureus has a lot of passion and interest in. My first sort of thing I wanted to discuss with you and my thing I wanted to explore was the index and why in 2023 it's important for brands to be aspiring to be in something like the Sport for Good Index. Why should brands be trying to use their own positive power and positioning for good, basically?
So like for me, firstly, as a Laureus Academy member, I've been able to witness and see firsthand the power that sport truly has to play in impacting the world positively. I was a 12-year-old boy in 1995, a year on from South Africa's first democratic elections, and what you're seeing, sport unify, bring people together, break down your socioeconomic boundaries, racial boundaries, and really just understand the ability for sport to propel people into this united front. And I think in the current world that we live in, everyone is sometimes trying to do their own thing. And as great as that is, the biggest impact sometimes can be achieved collaboratively. And that really is where the Laureus Sport for Good Index comes about. And it's celebrating brands that, again, through collaboration, a little bit of innovation and creativity, really are making a significant contribution in creating social change. And that particularly around the 17 sustainable developmental goals, which has been laid out by the UN. So I think the index is really a platform where, through collaboration, greater success, greater impact can be had, but also recognizing brands that are trying to do their best to make this world a better place. And, across those 17 sustainable goals, where they potentially have key expertise in, and to be able to utilize that to the best of their ability. So it's really great that Laureus has sort of come forward with a Sports for Good Index. It is now on the third year, that we're doing it. And, hopefully through the education of a market around what it is all about and understanding how powerful the impact of collaboration can be, the Laureus Sports for Good Index will continue to gain a massive amount of success and traction, as we continue this.
Obviously, it goes without saying, you've been an athlete. Obviously, within that, you've worked with a number of brands during the course of your career. Speaking very specifically about the time that we live in, why is it you think that it's important now more than ever for brands to be using their platform as a sort of object for positive change, especially in sports, but it could be, anything really.
I think that the beauty of collaboration of brands coming together is that you get to see uniquely exceptional expertise in certain fields. And, Laureus, not only globally, but in South Africa, where, they fund so many incredible programs. As much as they'd love to be hands-on, they lead the hands-on expertise to those that are best equipped to do it. And I think ability for brands to potentially focus on, their values, their cultures within an organizational perspective and properly impact that. Then to chat about DHL and, how they're using the avenues and platforms, where they are progressively dominant in, but using that in a way in which social change can be brought about, educating people, but using their voice through what their company values or culture is to really propel that. And I think we all need to make a difference, right? As much as we understand the opportunity that sport has to, bring about social change, this world is unfortunately, still very divided, still very segregated. varying opinions or thoughts, religion, culture, but sport truly is that one medium that, you know, doesn't worry about all of those things and just brings the ability of people coming together to achieve success and the ability for brands to leverage off that. You know, I'm very fortunate to, you know, be in Paris and see a extremely transformed African rugby team win a World Cup. Now, the first Black African captain to not only win a World Cup once, but become the first African captain to do it back to back. And you see the scenes of, you know, people from all various backgrounds in South Africa coming together in celebrating success from a sporting perspective, but celebrating the ability that that team has been able to do to inspire and give hope and show what can be possible if you put your differences aside, work extremely hard towards a common goal, and remain resilient, you know, despite the adversities that, you know, that they get faced with. So I think brands can leverage off that, you know, but focusing on their key areas of strength and where they can collaboratively then come together, you know, through something like the Loris Sports Index, it means that, you know, even greater success can be achieved.
Yeah, I think what you said there about how they can use what they're good at is kind of key in terms of like what brands can actually do, like, and how brands can deliver that. Is it that organizational side? Is it that sort of like we bring the specialism to this area in order to promote that messaging?
The index was created to really spotlight and celebrate the impact that brands can have to invest properly, to encourage more investment for the power of sport to bring about social change. And I think that is really important. As Loris, that have been doing it for just over 20 years now, really championing that global movement to understanding the power that sports has to bring about best practice in a sector that really needs it. Everyone's doing their own thing around the world, but collaboratively, as you can tap into those various networks and understand potentially how others do their area of expertise better than you, you know, you can leverage off that incredible IP and become better at what you're doing. So again, we're not trying to sort of segregate or ring fence certain people, you know, just bringing together a platform. There's no ulterior motive but to leverage off the ability to progressively make this world a better place and also to give brands a voice. You know, sometimes they don't really know how or where to tap in. And like the Loris IP or expertise, you know, in the fact that they've been going for over 20 years in this environment, you know, create some real trust, but honestly, in which brands can leverage off to create and gain further success within the space.
I'd like to actually, if we could move on to talk a little bit about your own experiences with working with brands, and we can come on to DHL a little bit later, but like just sort of like on a practical level or an enthusiasm level, when you felt like the project you were working on wasn't just an ad campaign where you say turned up and raced the cheetah, but it's something with a little bit more deeper impact. Is that something you enjoyed more? Is that something you got more invested in?
So firstly, the only reason I raced against the cheetah was because of the underlying message of the cheetah using its race to become an extinct animal. And being in South Africa, we're very fortunate to have some incredible game reserves, have wildlife, you know, at our doorstep. And I grew up being able to witness the big five in South Africa, you know, going on father and son weekends. And you know, the cheetah, you know, as much as I was fast, the cheetah is this incredibly beautiful, majestic creature that just was struggling in a plight that it was losing a race. And you know, as much as it had become very publicized, plenty for the wrong reasons, what it did do was create a lot of understanding of the cheetah, you know, can potentially beat man in a physical foot race, but it's losing the race against man, you know, in its fight against extinction. And yes, you know, you see the promotions, you see the YouTube videos, but it has created a lot of awareness around that. So for me, as much as it was sort of this exhibition type experience, the underlying ability was to get an organization like Chevron back then, I think it was, who understood what the Devolt Cheetah Tracker program were trying to do. You know, again, creating the collaboration of brands coming together. You have the expertise of the Devolt Cheetah Tracker program, you know, who takes in cheetahs that have either been severely injured or wounded, you know, in the wild, you know, rehabilitate them to then make sure that they can go back into the wild and live a decent life. All of a sudden you have Chevron coming on board and really pushing that key message. So I think for me, it's, you know, when you do work with the best brands in the world, and I've been very fortunate, you know, the likes of HSBC, MasterCard, Land Rover, and Adidas, it's an incredible brand, you know, Adidas and their quality campaigns, recycling, like the plastic out of the oceans. HSBC, you know, both at an elite but grassroots level, and we are driving sustainable change in terms of how things happen. MasterCard, you know, being able to fund, you know, women's rugby in particular and the growth thereof. So all these brands are doing so much brilliant work. And I think for me, the value perspective that I sit in, you know, not only being a Loris Academy member, having my own foundation, but really understanding the power and impact that sport can have, because I've been fortunate enough to live and breathe that. You know, I've seen firsthand, I've been able to win a World Cup and witness it firsthand, bringing that trophy back to South Africa. And 12 years later, you see Siya Kolisi and his team become the most transformed Springbok team in the history of our country. So I really do understand that perspective and how we can then leverage off that to bring about this incredibly important social change perspective, which in my opinion, without a doubt, makes the world a better place to live in.
I just want to, I guess when it came to like those campaigns, right, if your agent or whoever it was that you were working with on that, on those things, if they came to you and said, we've got this campaign, would one of your questions be like, okay, but what's the bigger message here? Is that something you thought about in that moment?
I definitely think it's one of the messages I would have thought about. For me, it's about, okay, what are we trying to achieve through this? You know, are we growing a brand? Are we really portraying to the world this brand's ability to not only have a voice through its ambassadors, influencers, whatever you want to call that, but that it is aligning with not only their purpose, but my purpose? You know, it's not always easy, but to then be able to really just skim through, you know, the upper level of foam and really dig deep and to see the sustainable change that is wanting to be created, because you do these campaigns and it's not only a one-day thing, you know, you've almost got to see it through over a number of weeks, months, years. And that is where, for me, I really look at that component of it and how we can do it appropriately. So is it always easy? No. Are your values always the same? Mostly. You know, there might be, you know, one or two key differentials in certain instances. And it's not just knowing the top brass of, you know, of an organization. It's about understanding, you know, how they look after their people, how they invest, you know, in continued wellness, you know, for their own organization and drive change from the inside out.
Over the course of your career, you kind of worked in an era when rugby was becoming increasingly professional, having been not that before. I'm guessing, like, maybe not necessarily your team, but maybe some of your older teammates, when they were first starting to work with brands, it was just a case of, okay, like, how much am I earning and what have I got to do? Did you see that change? Did brands realize and your teammates realize that, like, actually that wasn't going to be something that would work out long term?
I was really fortunate upon that at the start of my career. I want to say that whole understanding of what a partnership was all about changed. I mean, there were certain, you know, sort of quick in and out campaigns that you did for a brand when it was, you had to promote a certain product or service, and that was specifically around that. But it was about, for me, really important in creating a relationship. So many of the brands that I've worked with over the course of my career hasn't just been sort of this one-take wonder. You know, I look up at every one of my 124 test matches in Adidas rugby boots. I've been with MasterCard for the last 7 years. I've been with HSBC for the last 8 years. I had the same insurance team that I did a campaign for a week after I'd signed up with them and then left to New Zealand and had a break-in and 20 ideas still on. I'm still working with them. So for me, I think it was really important to build the relationship with a brand that you can feel you associate with, a brand that is not only the best in its class, but extends its social footprint further than an ad campaign, extends its values and that proposition further than an ad campaign. And that was always very important to me. And I was fortunate enough that when I started out my career, brands had already started looking at various ways of using their impact as an opportunity to tackle the various social challenges that are faced by so many globally. And these problems aren't something that are easy to resolve over one day. And if you give a person a ball in a rural township in South Africa, there's not much can happen with that ball. But if you teach them the skill set of rugby and the values around what rugby gives you in terms of the respect, the camaraderie, the discipline, the perseverance, the resilience, you know, then you sort of start changing lives. You know, during COVID, we saw a hiking ability of people to help out when it came to, you know, delivery of food parcels. But that food parcel, you know, was maybe there for 2 or 3 weeks. You know, in South Africa, we have just over 40% unemployment rate in the minute. And, you know, that is extremely challenging and complicated to resolve on your own. You know, through the sports index at Loris have been given brands the opportunity to leverage, or, you know, how do you look at a true sustainable opportunity to bring about social change, which is really important. So I've seen the progression thereof, and it's been incredible to see how brands have continued plying, you know, millions and millions of rands, dollars, euros, pounds, you know, into trying to create a positive impact. And, you know, hopefully, you know, through this collaboration that is the Loris Sports for Good Index, we're giving brands even a further opportunity to collaboratively, you know, gain expertise in areas that they probably don't have, but show them, you know, what the true opportunity is to create social change.
Mm. One of the brands on the index is obviously one you're very familiar with, DHL. They've been included for their work in the field of like sustainability. That's kind of amongst many different things. But as you said, it goes back to what you were talking about, specialization, right? They're able to talk about sustainability because their whole job is figuring out how to get things from A to B in the most efficient manners. What's your work like been with them? Is that always something that's been kind of core to them? And how important is, do you think, that brands are able to kind of stick to like their core messaging when it comes to what they're good at, when they're talking about using sport for good? Sorry, that was a very long-winded question.
No. Okay. So first off, I haven't had the privilege or honor to be invited to any of the Formula One races this season to see firsthand the impact that the DHL, you know, biofuel trucks are having. But yeah, I know the team really well. They've done quite a bit of work. They became the sponsors of the Stormers when I arrived down in Cape Town in 2010. And it's just been amazing to see various brands. And I'm, again, fortunate that I've worked with quite a few over the course of the last 20-odd years. But how various brands, to your point, specialize in what they're good at. And, you know, DHL, not only with the work they're doing with their biofuel, you know, powered trucks, you know, throughout the Formula One season, but they've also now got looking at the investment into the clean logistics of how things happen. And they've also been recognized for work with the Formula E to get a Green Award, a legacy program, which again is the sort of future progressive opportunity to understand, you know, where renewable energy or fuel consumption, the negative impact of petrol, diesel, you know, all the things that are potentially seen as bad, you know, how they can leverage off their platform to firstly have a voice, but secondly, to be able to make sure that the voice is being heard because of their speciality in that industry. And they can then give key metrics to everyone else to be able to understand that. So now take a DHL in comparison to a MasterCard. You know, MasterCard aren't going to have any trucks driving around the world. So they're not going to be able to gather any metrics of how, or they might have trucks, they might not have the massive amount of trucks that DHL have. So all of a sudden, the greater metric analyzation thereof, you know, can mean a more profound impact for those that don't have the ability to measure at that, you know, finite level, which I think is really important. So it is great to see how specialization of certain IP experience leads to, through collaboration, the ability to share on a global platform, which I think is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. And final thing, just sort of looking ahead a little bit, I guess, do you think sort of from a consumer perspective, do you see a trend essentially from consumers that they're going to be more attracted towards those kind of brands that are providing that positive messaging and telling you about what they're doing that's good in the world, especially when it comes to sport, which obviously, as you said, brings so many people together?
Firstly, you're not going to please everyone. And I think that's really important. For me, the Laureus Sports Store Index really does give people a platform to understand the various idiosyncrasies that the world has, the various differentiating opportunities to achieve success, but how vastly different each and every organization is and how, you know, through that vast difference, we can learn so much. And, you know, consumers are always going to be driven by their own personal gains, but how are we aligning a value proposition, you know, to the consumer collaboratively? And that's whether they support football, rugby, athletics, soccer, Formula One. Are we able to leverage off the key messaging tools, but metrics, you know, from an experiential experience perspective, brands can measure and then pass on? And I think that's important. Everyone's going to be fighting, you know, for bottom line GP, you know, making sure that their brand message is getting across. But, you know, how through a platform like Laureus Sports for Good Index do we really provide tools which could potentially tackle some of the most challenging problems in the world? And, you know, we can aid and assist your experience to be able to make sure that counts as best possible.
All right, Brian. I think, mate, that's a lovely place to leave it. Thanks very much for your time today and been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thanks, Don. Great to be here.
Harish Sarma, welcome to the Sports Pro podcast.
Nice to meet you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. We're here to talk a little bit today about the Laureus Sport for Good Index and basically how TikTok found itself on this list. And as people that have sort of been tracking it for the last 3 years know, the process isn't so much that brands nominate themselves and tell us how good they are. It's all about brands that work in sports being identified as those socially positive actors. One of the reasons why TikTok was identified was its work, particularly in women's sports. What I'd kind of like to start with is just to get a little bit of a picture as to why that was such a focus when TikTok was starting to look into sports. I mean, obviously you've got those tie-ups with Burnley, the Six Nations and the Women's World Cup. Was that a sort of deliberate thing that TikTok was thinking about when it was putting together its strategy in sports?
Well, first, Tom, I want to just acknowledge, you know, the nomination here. You know, as you mentioned, it's really interesting to be part of a process where we don't necessarily have a direct hand in the nominations process. So it's incredibly humbling and rewarding to see a lot of the work that the team here at TikTok has done to further, you know, the agenda here on women's sport and broadly with the inclusivity in sport. So just want to first acknowledge that it's Sport for Good is an important endeavor, and we're really, really happy to be proud of this, happy to be part of this as well. On the question specifically, it's like, why, right? So I'd say traditionally, and again, I'd love to hear if you have a different view on this, but I think traditionally there hasn't been as much emphasis, I would say, on creating equal opportunities to grow both the men's and the women's game. I think there's always been this sort of challenge where the women's game has been in many ways compared to the men's game. And the questions have always been about, well, does it stack up? Are there equivalences you can make? And if so, is it worth investing in? You know, we felt that it was not only important because we have a focus on DE&I, but we actually wanted to demonstrate it through action. And so this sort of took a bit of a leap, right? You could say you are really, really pro DE&I and you have initiatives and you support it, but how are you actually demonstrating it? And so everything you just called out, so you mentioned Burnley, you mentioned what we've done for the Women's Six Nations, most recently what we did for the Women's World Cup, these are absolutely deliberate. And the way to think about them is I would sort of breadcrumb them because you have something that's happening at a team level that's very specific to Burnley Women's. It's impacting a team and it's impacting a type of team that either doesn't have a distribution outlet, for example, for their games, or you have something that's happening in rugby because the sport itself isn't as consumed as, say, other sports. And so there's an angle there and how the women's game is impacted there. Or something like the FIFA Women's World Cup, which is probably at the pinnacle of the sporting disciplines vis-a-vis like the sport itself and then how much attention that sport garners, right? So how does that stack up? And how does women's game stack up there? So if you think about these different examples, they may look similar, but they're actually very, very different. And so our perspective has been, how are we doing things at each one of these layers so that we can, in many ways, showcase whether those efforts have actually borne fruit for, you know, women's sport. So that's been the thinking there from the beginning.
And when it came to setting out that plan or setting out that strategy, you mentioned right at the start there that it's always a kind of comparison between men's sports and women's sports, right? And often in a way that positions women's sports as like, well, it's not as important. The numbers aren't there. Were there in fact numbers that you guys were looking at when you were putting these together that actually suggested, look, this isn't just a kind of a thing we want to do because we think it's the right thing to do. It's also a thing to do because it makes business sense.
Yeah. I always start with, you know, it's much easier to make the case for doing something, the right thing and something that's good, if there's an economic argument behind it, right? I think the challenge has been cart before the horse, right? There's a lot of folks who want to see sort of equivalences to the men's game, even on the commercial side, in spite of not having put in the time, the effort, and frankly, the investment, right? That the men's game has received over many, many years, right? You know, we're talking centuries. That's sort of the magnitude we're describing here. Now, if we were to actually think about what's realistic, you're not going to have those obvious like indicators that say this is a direct equivalent. But what you will see is participation. You will see growth in the actual engagement around, you know, specific disciplines. You'll also see share of voice. You'll see a shifting in, well, if somebody had way more options to consume women's sport, what happens then, right? Do you actually have the same level of consumption as you did before, or do you have more? And the easiest thing, and candidly, the most exciting thing about, frankly, being TikTok in this scenario is the consumer actually makes that choice, right? The consumer is the one that's deciding, I find this stuff really compelling, so I'm going to watch more of it. You know, the algorithm then serves up something similar to that. And if they continue to consume it, that's a positive signal right there. It basically says that consumer and then likely others like them are looking for the same. So I would say a lot of that was the basis for our thinking. I think it was a combination of that plus, frankly, the intent to really follow what we believed was A, the right thing to do, but also what we felt was sort of the latent demand, right? If you look at the ecosystem, how much actual access do people have to women's sport? Like in actuality, like people may have opinions about it, but how much are people actually watching? How many videos have people actually consumed? How much can they actually speak to it? We found out very quickly that there was this sort of like, you know, disconnect between the perception and the consumption side. So people had perceptions, but they had not necessarily consumed much in the way there. So we said, well, I think one way to really figure this out is how about we find a way to get more of this content in front of people, and then we'll actually know, and then they will actually know whether they care or they don't. And turned out it was a pretty good line to follow because more and more people discovered women's sport this way, and this has been proven out. I mean, I have some numbers I can share.
Yeah, that would be great.
Just to give you a sense of scale here, right? So macro across all sports on the women's side, hashtag women's sport on TikTok generated 244 billion views, right? So that's nothing to snooze at. Just at a sport level, you know, hashtag women's football generated 4.6 billion views. I mentioned earlier the FIFA Women's World Cup, which a lot of times gets compared to men's tentpoles of a similar variety, not just the men's World Cup, but other tentpoles. That itself drew 4.7 billion views. The Lionesses, I mentioned this connection between the team layer, the macro layer. So the team layer, the Lionesses drove about 2.3 billion views themselves. And so my point is the list can go on, and these kind of numbers I can share are in the similar ilk. But the idea is really that it's there. The latent demand has been there. It just has never been addressed. And so we really just sort of connected the dots here, right? And I think that was probably the simplest thing, but also the most complicated thing. You sort of had to like agree that this was important enough to prioritize.
I guess when you're clocking up that many views or that much interest, it's an easier case to make to the people that you're wanting to do that. When you talk about connecting the dots, what does that actually mean? If we could take a maybe look at like Burnley, for example, when you're working with their women's team, what does that connecting the dots look like almost on a practical level to support them in their goals?
Yeah. So I'd say every team, every federation that is in the women's game, they are sort of facing a different set of challenges, right? That's very specific and potentially bespoke to them. Burnley Women's, for example, doesn't face the same challenges as, say, other women's teams. So like the Portland Thorns, for example, or Lyon, like have very different goals and very different challenges. And so what we were faced with when we spoke with Burnley Women's was this idea of creating access to their product, what they were doing, though, what they were doing on the field. So the actual distribution of Burnley Women's games, it was not in place. And so we basically, you know, we have a product, a live product that exists kind of side by side with our VOD product. Effectively, you know, a lot of folks will sort of think live is, you know, something that, you know, exists on many platforms. So what about TikTok? Does that make sense for us? And we basically said, it looks like that's the area that you sort of want to lean in and frankly get more awareness of your games. And as the women's team, I think one of the biggest challenges for them is they're sort of looking for how do you build a commercial case why you should lean in with Burnley Women's. And so what about if we started this whole idea of generating a fan? And how are they going to become fans of Burnley Women's? They're, you know, if they might see a VOD post, but how are they going to know? What's the context? So we started with this whole idea of expanding the aperture of the number of live games that they would actually have on TikTok to the point where they would also include VOD posts that would follow that. But think of it as like this sort of appointment viewing type opportunity with a brand you've never even heard of, right? And with a women's team that you'd never even connected with. So you start to build an association with the lineups, the players themselves, their style of play, things you would have never probably even thought you maybe even cared about, but you found out that you did because you were then exposed to it. So it's sort of like this idea of behind the paywall or behind any sort of like distribution medium, the barrier is access. And so if every team is behind this wall, yes, some teams will be able to get through because either they're bigger brands or they've built an easier pathway to get access to them, either through distribution deals that are in place. But what if the vast majority of teams don't have that? And, you know, I would argue that that was the case for Burnley. You know, that was sort of the opportunity as well, right? And so I have to say, this sort of took both sides sort of agreeing that this was a big enough challenge for them that they wanted to take a flyer on doing it this way. And so there is an element of trust here, Tom. I don't want to underestimate that. And so you know, I want to credit the teams on both sides. Definitely our partners at Burnley and, you know, the team at TikTok, who basically said, look, let's get together. Let's try this. If it doesn't look like it's working, we can always pivot. But if it is working, we should probably think about doubling down on this. And it turned out the latter was exactly what happened. That ended up scaling, you know, the number of live minutes that they delivered, I think, was in terms of like viewed live minutes was astounding. And they could not replicate that on any other platform. At least they had not seen it on their side. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe they were able to ultimately land that sponsor that they were looking for at the start of the process through this. And so that was a really great win, I would say, coming out of all of this, when you would not think, you know, normally you would think that the whole distribution path is not really the way you would think about it. You almost think about it the other way. You start with sponsorship, and then ultimately, if you get big enough, you end up on the distribution side. Well, we did it on the flip. And so that's an example of how we did it with Burnley and how it was really specific to them.
Yeah, to me, that's really fascinating in that, because what you talk about there, that's ultimately the triple win, right? You guys are winning. You're getting more people looking at them all hours of their content. They're winning because they're kind of getting what they want out of it in terms of distribution. And then they get the extra win in terms of that additional revenue into the club. So that for me is almost like the perfect example of what a brand doing sport for good is aiming for. I guess the thing with Burnley is that you're able to take something that you're not able to take with most sports properties, which is live rights. And so when it comes to something like the Six Nations, you're playing with slightly different content. And I'd be interested to see maybe with that one as well, because it's, let's be honest, like rugby is slightly more niche than football. How does that then work? You've got this one thing that you were doing with Burnley. How did you think, oh, right, okay, well, we've done that there. We can't quite do exactly the same thing. What do we do with this?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, look, there's definitely not a situation where you sort of get to close your eyes, right? And then run the same play, as they say in American parlance, right? That isn't something, frankly, that we could even do at the team level. It may seem like you could possibly do that because you say, I'm a team, that's a team, we should probably do the same thing. It is way more individual and way more customized than that. And that's because the goals of each of those teams and the, you know, the positions of each of those teams are different, one. And then number two, you're also facing different challenges. And in this case, like you mentioned, the Six Nations, you know, the live rights are spoken for. So you can't play in that arena. It's not even open. So what can you do? I think it's basically thinking about what happens around the actual live window, right? We've spent so much time thinking about the 2 hours or so, depending on what the sport is, of the live window, because that's where all the attention is, all the eyeballs are. But in a week or in a lead up to that 2 hour window, there's all this time. And I don't call it dead time, but it's like, it's all the pregame time. And then there's all the post-game time. You spend so much of this in preparation, if you're a fan. You also spend a lot of this in learning. If you're somebody who's just trying to get their head around what's coming up this weekend or specifically around a match, you sort of don't know. And if you're thinking about Six Nations, it's similar because your journey, both with rugby and then specifically with the Six Nations, is a one of discovery, because that's actually probably the most valuable thing you can do, sort of provide context for the live viewer, right? So when someone dives in and ultimately consumes a live product, they are not seeing this player for the first time. They're seeing a cast of characters that they sort of have an idea of. This was literally the phenomenon. Again, everyone is sort of like jumping on this and has been jumping on this for a while, but this is the type to surviving of everything, right? And so in many ways, people either fell in love with specific characters and almost then by default became aware that the sport was interesting enough for them to sort of make an effort and then follow. So that, I would say, is where we excelled and probably spent the most of our time with Six Nations. It's all the other stuff that we did around, right? It's all the access pieces that we did. It's all the locker room stuff. It's all the following players on team buses. It's all the stuff that they captured on their own, the players did, and so did the teams. And I will say that is very TikTok, right? That's probably the part of this platform that, you know, say resonates the most when people think of us. They're not necessarily thinking about us vis-a-vis the live game, but they are thinking about us for all these other aspects. And so that's what I would say we did differently with Six Nations. And again, pretty typical, right? That's something that we would do with others too.
Mm-hmm. We talked a fair bit about content so far. Probably a good time to consider a platform too, right? Like you mentioned it there. Maybe if we start with the Swipe Out Hate campaign and just explain what that is and why it needs to exist, I guess.
Yeah, this is a good one and very near and dear. So, you know, this was announced, this will maybe even surprise you, but this was announced back in May 2021, right? So this was right around when the Euro 2020 was rescheduled, right? This is, you know, post-COVID. And this was right around the kickoff. And the message and the logic to us was pretty clear, right? There's no place in TikTok, for example, for racism and hate speech. And while football has made tremendous strides in this area, we felt that taking a clear stance on this issue that is so near and dear to us was the right move. This campaign really fits with our ethos, right? And in many ways, it's core to the TikTok experience. If you're somebody who's a user, you're going to be very, very aware of the fact that there isn't really any sort of discrimination against whether someone looks a certain way, produces a certain type of content, takes a creative approach that's different from yours. That's actually all part of the mix, right? And so it's something we've spelled out really clearly in our community guidelines. We have a zero tolerance policy for hate speech and any sort of divisive, you know, language. So for us, I'd say the Swipe Out Hate campaign was sort of the manifestation of our internal ethos, but just very much in line with others who have sort of taken a very similar stance, but are sort of going down a very specific path, right? They're calling out either racism more specifically, or they're calling out some of the negative elements, right, that are in the sport that are tied in. So for us, we just felt that this was very much us, this very much spoke to our DNA and made a lot of sense.
On the platform then, like, how does that play out, right? Like, almost like technically, like, how does it work from a TikTok backend view?
Yeah, so I'd say the first thing is you have to create the platform, right? So you have to create an opportunity for everyone can have an opinion. They either be very, very proactive in how they engage with the message, or they can sort of be a consumer. They can be a quiet consumer of this. And so they then get influenced by that message. What happened was basically what you probably think would happen, right? I think the players took the lead on a lot of this, a lot of the athletes, because they're the ones who are in the front lines. They're the ones who are playing the sport, who are either privy to some form of racism, some form of hate speech, and may have been victims themselves, or they witness it, right, in some way, shape, or form. And so if you start to see a lot of people that you will recognize, and recognize them either on the pitch or on the field or on the court, talking about it more, and also sort of providing their point of view, which is effectively saying this is unacceptable, not just in, you know, in the sport, but just period, all of a sudden you have this groundswell of interest. So we ended up having a lot of athletes that sort of raised their hand and said, I want to be part of this campaign. I would actually want to be somebody that will do it. I'm going to do this anyway. I'm going to, you know, I will create content and I will likely allow others to stitch with this content, or I may just post this content because I feel very strongly about this, because I've been personally affected, or I know somebody who is actually going through this themselves. So I think it got very personal, you know, in the right way. And I always feel like a lot of times we spend a lot of time talking about like what's working and how great, you know, stuff looks, at least on paper. And then, you know, commercially speaking, and it's a great enterprise, but we don't necessarily want to highlight some of these challenges that we're all facing and that are sort of areas that we frankly should eliminate, that they shouldn't exist. And I think the question was more, this isn't a debate. We've sort of historically just looked the other way or sort of avoided shining a light in these dark corners. And so instead of doing that, we said, well, why don't we just lean into it? Why don't we just ask folks to share that view and frankly allow fans to then engage with those players in that way? And I will say it's an emotional conversation, but it's the right conversation. And you know, it's very, again, it's very TikTok.
That's a kind of marked difference, I think, from, let's say, Twitter, where that kind of stuff is much more kind of left to the devices of the market, and the market in that case being its users. That's the athlete side. What about the fan side? It's not a high-profile athlete saying, I have this problem, this is bad, let's try and fix it. Fans just generally creating content, like having to deal with the hate that athletes are trying to campaign against. Like, what do you do around that kind of messaging? How do you clamp that out and make sure that stays not part of TikTok, if you see what I mean?
I think the first thing is no form of hate speech or racism is acceptable on TikTok. Like, no form. Whether that's leveled at an athlete or leveled at an individual in a piece of content or in a comment, it's just not acceptable. So we have a zero tolerance policy for that type of content or that type of language. And so that hopefully, I hope, puts you at ease in the context of we're not sort of creating a safe space for athletes with the Swipe Out Hate campaign that doesn't apply to everybody else. In fact, the idea is that we're saying Swipe Out Hate, period. We're not saying Swipe Out Hate in sport. It so happens that sport's a great vehicle for this. But in many cases, what would happen or what has been happening, in fact, I get a lot of this content myself, is a lot of users share their personal experiences in whatever walk of life they're in, right? And could that be in the context of sport? Sure. It could be something that happened to them when they were playing a sport. It could be that they felt the racism played a role in what happened to them on the field, potentially, or, you know, with fans or in other interactions. Or it could have nothing to do with that. It could just have sparked this conversation that I was a victim of some form of malicious intent. In this case, it could be hate speech. It could be anything. And that's something I want to share. And it turns out that the community is really, really open to, hey, you need to tell your story. We want to hear your story. We understand that there's probably some pain, some trauma that you need to process, and we're here for it. And because we have a real strong focus on the safety of the platform being paramount, and meaning the safe space where we don't, frankly, have any tolerance for hate speech and racism, it means you can do so without feeling that you may get attacked as a response to that. You can actually share with freedom. And then others get to say, okay, I either experienced something similar to you, or mine was a little different. Here's what happened with me. Thoughts on this? And so being able to help people process what they've gone through, you know, separate maybe perception and maybe what has happened with them, I think is a big part of it as well. But just being able to have a place where you can talk about this stuff. And again, we've been talking a lot about sport, but at the end of the day, sport is part of life. And it's in many ways, for so many, right? Sport is almost endemic to being a core element of life. And so it's a vehicle. And so we really, really felt that this was something that applied to everybody. And that was the whole idea of it. And so, yes, the athletes are creating videos and they're speaking about it. And they have the platforms and they have the fans and they have the recognizability to be able to sort of garner, right, a lot of interest because of who they are. But at the same time, it's the everyday TikToker that, frankly, was directly either impacted by this and then was able to then tell their story. And this happens a lot, right, where you don't just see a string of athlete videos one after the other when you're consuming sport on TikTok. It does actually, very quickly, it gets into the community world where someone shares something and it just has done really, really well because it resonates.
Final thing before I let you go, I just want to kind of more broadly talk about the idea of TikTok as a brand, how and where this using sport for good journey goes, and like what you do next as TikTok's usage grows, as TikTok partners with more and more properties. How do you make sure that you keep those individualistic campaign methods that you use with Burnley and with the Six Nations? Is it just about as soon as you come into a new partnership breaking, like, okay, how do we do this? How do we make sure this fits exactly with what we want it to do?
I love this because this is the what's next question, right? It's almost like, how do you take this and do with this what it should ultimately become? I'd say the first step of that process for us has been, you had to prove out the, you know, the use case, and you had to prove out that you could actually deliver sport for good. And you said it best, right? You create this triple threat situation where everybody wins and there's actually a true way to measure it as a success. That's sort of the scalability model is the next step of this, right? Which is, how do you do this and how do you make this turnkey? How do you get this to a place where if you can profile, or you profile like a Burnley, we have a playbook for you and we can show you the path to getting there with consistency, right? That's sort of the thinking from our side. If it's much more macro, and we're talking about things like, we talked about swipe out hate, but we're talking about something much more macro, how can we materially and meaningfully show that we've changed the discourse? And I think that's a much bigger challenge, but definitely one we're up for, right? So I think the first step in all of these situations is you have to prove your credibility. And no one's going to back you if they don't actually see what it is you've done or what you've been able to achieve. We've had to first do that. And candidly, when you think about women's sport as the backdrop, it's very tough. And talk to anybody who's in the space, because they almost feel like most of the times they're fighting uphill, right? They're sort of speaking very loudly, and they're not necessarily sure if a lot of people are receiving it. And we're sort of trying to take maybe the approach of, let's let the consumer do the talking. Let the consumer make the determination as to whether or not, A, they find this super interesting and super compelling, and B, whether they're now going to willingly want to invest time, effort, and ultimately, right, that means commercial outcomes for those entities. There's nothing that's more powerful than that in our eyes. So the scalability phase of this is what, frankly, we're going to move towards next. And we've already been thinking about this. We've been thinking about this for a while. But it doesn't hurt to have a string of things that we can point to that are very much less one-hit wonder, one-off things that, frankly, a lot of folks can probably point to. But when you sort of do them in mass and you sort of do them also with a fair bit of consistency, you start to change the, you know, the conversation. You know, I also want to clarify, there isn't a monolithic structure to this specific to women's sport in every market. Like, women's sport, as it has advanced and has in many ways not advanced in very differing degrees, market to market. So every region, every market, and every team in those regions, every player in those regions is impacted differently by that journey. And so while we may be much further along in specific markets, right, in terms of kind of getting people on board and getting people sort of to sort of see this, where we're going with this, in some cases, you know, we're at the starting blocks. And that's not to say we're discouraged. It just means we know what we're collectively up against. So this isn't really one of those, you know, stage two across the board and everyone is, you know, here. I think we know that we have to do different things. We have to sort of stay on message and we have to sort of be really, really committed to doing this in every market that we go to, right? So just to give you a sense of what I'm talking about, in Latin America, for example, football femenino, you know, itself as a hashtag has driven 2.2 billion views. Now, that basically says it's very, very different than, say, what you're seeing in the European game, but it's showing the same level of propensity to prioritize women's sport. And most people would not necessarily assume that, right? And so what does that mean? It means that we sort of have to give every region its due, and we have to also build those solutions with the view that we're not going to be necessarily going to be able to just sort of like do it one way and then just scale. We might have to do it very, very specifically with certain sort of execution in certain markets. But for us, I mean, I think the goal here has got to be, how do we take this and how do we scale this up? So that's a very long answer for what should have been a short one.
No, that was great. Also, I think probably a really nice place to leave it, actually. Harish Sharma, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.